My work is done.
The public hearing on
public hearing?
House Bill 2658.
And work sessions.
And committee, I'm going to close. Now that I've opened it up from the recess, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2658. I'm not going to work this bill today. We will move on and open a public hearing on House Bill 2673. Victoria, would you give us a brief description of the bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House Bill 2673 requires event producers, promoters, and venue owners to disclose numbers and classes of tickets available for public sale, and requires ticket resellers to disclose number of unsold tickets available for resale. Provides for enforcement as an unlawful trade practice.
Thank you. First up, we have two distinguished representatives, I think, that would like to kick this bill off. Representative Scott Bruin and Representative Sarah Gelser.
Which is which?
Who I believe have chief sponsored the bill before us. Good afternoon and welcome.
Hi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Representative Sarah Gelser from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. And for Representative Barton, I want to let you know this bill will not make you feel bad in any way.
Thank you, Representative.
I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2673. If passed, House Bill 2673 would require entertainment promoters and ticket resellers to disclose the number and quality of tickets that are available for sale. Currently, vendors and promoters are able to release tickets in waves to artificially inflate the prices of the tickets. Promoters actively seek to give consumers the impression that the current tickets on the market will be the only ones available. This can have very expensive consequences for consumers. These ticket inflating practices are especially predatory, in my view, to parents who may be more willing to pay ridiculous prices to see their children's favorite artists. For any of us who have had the distinct pleasure to take our children to see esteemed artists such as The Wiggles or Barney, we might know how excited our children might be to see these laughing, dancing people who rival Representative Gilliam in their entertainment value. In fact, this bill that we are talking about here is commonly referred to as the Hannah Montana bill because it was Hannah Montana's first U.S. tour that brought this problem to the forefront. Because of a lack of transparency, the tour turned into a ticket debacle that left parents to pay several times the face value for their tickets, unaware that more tickets would be released later. Not all of you may be aware who Hannah Montana, also known as Miley Cyrus, secret superstar, is. But as the parent of three daughters between the ages of 8 and 11, they have educated me extensively about the joys and importance of artists like Hannah Montana and the revered Jonas Brothers. I can imagine how difficult it must be to tell your children in such a circumstance that they cannot see their favorite artist because the tickets are too expensive, only to then find out that the prices had been artificially inflated and you could have taken them to this concert after all. In the instance of the Hannah Montana concert, many parents bought tickets in the resale market for hundreds of dollars above the face value. In fact, in the Portland market, those tickets were listed at up to $2,000 to $2,500 per ticket. When my children wanted to go and we got online to see those tickets, we determined it would be cheaper to take my entire family to Disneyland for several days than to drive up to Portland to take them to see the Hannah Montana concert. Many of these parents would not have been duped if they knew the real supply of the tickets. These parents were vulnerable to these high ticket prices because of the intensity of desire from their children to see these artists. This bill, of course, does not argue that everyone should be able to afford ticket prices. It simply demands transparency so that the consumer has an accurate understanding of what tickets are available, when they are available, who is selling them, and what their true market value is. It protects consumers from price gouging due to artificially managing the distribution of the available tickets. Whether you are a consumer wanting to see Hannah Montana, Bruce Springsteen, or Van Halen, these protections should be afforded to you. House Bill 2673 would be one of many Hannah Montana laws in place throughout the country, and it is a necessary update to protect consumers who are now buying their tickets online instead of at the box office. It's important to note that my co-sponsor and I are very interested in working with other stakeholders to amend the bill to make sure that it does what it says it's going to do. Most importantly, this bill is not intended to impact county fairs, small community theaters, the Portland Center for the Performing Arts, or the Portland Trailblazers. So we really want to work with these folks to make sure that it is really focused at these high-volume, very large-scale events where there are large numbers of tickets that are being sold. And I'll turn it over to Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Representative. I'm Representative Scott Bruin. I represent District 37, which is primarily Westland and Tualatin. Representative Gelser did a phenomenal job of giving the broad background to the bill. A little bit of history of where Rep. Gelser and I sort of came up with this was during our annual session last year, 2008, and it was soon, I don't remember exactly when the Hannah Montana concert was, but it had happened just a little time before there, maybe it was even during that time frame. And we just were talking on the House floor about what a racket it seemed to be just for normal people to try to get tickets, and put our heads together and over the interim, and this is how we got to this bill. Let me reiterate some things that Rep. Gelser said. This is not in any way intended to be a restriction on trade. It's not the intent to restrict a ticket seller's ability to sell tickets. What this is from I think our standpoint, consumer protection via information. Let me sort of simplify the arguments for this bill down to a simple example. You're a parent or yourself, and we're basically talking about large concert events, and whomever the promoter is or the ticket provider, they say get online at 10 o'clock Saturday morning, be the first to click the mouse, whatever, but you'll queue in and have an equal chance of tickets. And so you get in at 10 o'clock or 9:45, so you're ready to go at 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning. The clock strikes 10, you push buy, and you either find out that you're 80% back in whatever the particular venue is, or it kicks you out altogether and says, sorry, there's no tickets available, and directs you to one of these secondary ticket outlets, which instead of paying the face value on the ticket, the printed value, whatever the event is, if it's $65, $100, whatever the event is, it kicks you out to the second, basically resale, a legal scalping entity, which says the ticket's now $250 or $300 or $500 or $2,000 in the case of Hannah Montana. What this bill would do is not end that practice, frankly, at least the way the bill is written now. What this bill would do would tell the consumer, the parent, the concert goer, whatever the case may be, that when you go on at 10 o'clock on Saturday morning, here's the tickets that are going to be available. If the tickets aren't being diverted somewhere else, then hey, you may have an opportunity at front row, first come first serve. But maybe not, and that tends to be the case. What it's probably going to tell you is, well, get on at 10 o'clock, and you'll have the option to buy the remaining 20% of the 300 level tickets to see whatever the concert is. Hannah Montana was obviously the worst case scenario with this, and we realize this is not those sorts of events are infrequent, not frequent events, and this bill is designed to handle the infrequent large event. I mean, whether it's, as Rep. Gelser mentioned, whether it's Hannah Montana, Bruce Springsteen, Van Halen, the events that aren't every day. Once again, we're not trying to affect the sporting entities, certainly not the colleges or the professional sporting entities, which do this on a day, you know, four or five times a week. That's not what this bill is trying to get after, and we're very open and amenable to friendly amendments that would help protect those events. Let me close with one example of how this affected, and we probably all have seen this, but how it affected a friend of mine. So it was last May, a band that my best friend from high school and I wanted to see, and we had never seen, is a band called Rush. And it was one of those situations where the tickets are going to be on sale on a Saturday morning, so I gave him I'm going to pay him a cash. He was going to use his Visa, and he was going to be the one to get online at 10 o'clock or 8 o'clock, whatever time it was, on the given Saturday morning to go to this particular ticket outlet to buy them. And he was there on time. Well, I get a call from him a half hour later, and quote-unquote, dude, you won't believe what's on. And basically, bottom line, his point was there were no tickets left. So we ended up paying that. I mean, we wanted to see the band. We went to. I don't know if it was Craigslist or where we got them, but we got good tickets, paid a lot of money for them. But the fact of the matter was the event was promoted as, hey, if you're first come, first serve, if you're there at 10 o'clock, you have an equal chance of these tickets. And the fact of the matter is, we didn't. And we're not saying to prohibit that, but we are saying to tell me, the consumer, us, the consumers, that if that's the case, you need to let us know. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions?
Yes.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I thought that was scalping. I mean, I've always thought that was illegal, not to charge more than what the ticket price is. Isn't that scalping? I mean, I remember going to events and having people say, don't buy from scalpers. That's legal?
It's illegal in some states, as far as we can tell, and I don't want to misstate this, so you're getting this for what you're paying for it right now. But it's not illegal, whereas it may be enforced on the street side, say at a Blazer game, for example, if somebody's walking down the street and say, hey, I've got two great tickets, they're double the face value.
Right.
I'm under the impression, I may be wrong, but that is an enforceable scalping incident. The online version, so far as we can tell, is either legal or it's not enforced. And what's happening, once again, it was referred to as bots. They're called bots. Some of these scalping entities, sophisticated scalping entities, actually have computer software that goes on at 10 o'clock on the Saturday morning. So it has not, so in a situation like this, it would have nothing to do with the ticket seller themselves, at least the original, although sometimes it does, because in some of our research, we've discovered that there's, I won't name names because that's not what I'm trying to do here, but a ticket seller you've heard of has the primary ticket conveyor as well as a secondary related entity that also buys the tickets up. So you're immediately diverted within the same company from the original ticket to the more expensive secondary tickets. The bots actually call, or go online at 10 o'clock, and the software buys hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tickets, so an unsophisticated person sitting at their personal PC doesn't have the ability to beat that system, and that's why, several reasons why, but that's one reason why, you go to the back of the queue. Another thing that happens, and something that it was more prevalent, it was prevalent in the Handel Montana case, that was prevalent, but another issue that was prevalent as well is the promoters are saying you can get on at 10 o'clock and buy the tickets, but they've already distributed a significant portion, especially of the A tickets, if you will, to other entities. Those tickets were never available. And we're not talking about restricting promotion. I mean, promoters and ticket companies have their reasons for doing that, whether it's radio stations, whether it's even charitable. I mean, there's good reasons to do that. We're not sitting here criticizing that. What we're saying is you need to let the public know. You need to let the public know that if you get on at 10 o'clock, here's what's going to be available, and here's what's not going to be available.
And I think one of the things that's important to add to that is when you get directed to that site, what the consumer sees is a whole set of those tickets, all of them with that jacked up price. So the impression that the consumer has is that this is what the going rate is for this. There's so many people that are out there trying to get these. They're pumped up. And the saving grace for the companies when they don't sell them is that you get closer to that concert date, the weekend before, the day before. All of a sudden, the prices for those same tickets drop all the way back down. And to use the Hannah Montana concert as an example, we did not go. I love my children, but not enough to spend what would be a year's worth of college tuition to go see a concert. But I went back to check that weekend where they were about $2,500 per ticket a month out. The weekend before, you could get tickets for between $100 and $150. And if you can imagine being a consumer, a parent who had stepped up and shelled out $5,000 or $7,500 to take yourself and two of your children to this concert, to get there and end up sitting next to people who for tickets in the same section paid $450 that weekend, there's something really wrong with that system.
Interesting. So, when this bill first came to me, I kind of scoffed at it, thinking, what the heck is this? Didn't seem like much of an issue. But what you're describing really is people are making a business out of speculating on ticket sales and buying enormous amounts of tickets and then jacking the prices up and reselling them for a profit.
Thank you.
That's one aspect of it, Mr. Chair, and the other aspect of it is simply, once again, there's an element that's just promotional, that the tickets are going away, not because they're going to a scalping entity to raise the price, although that's maybe the paramount issue. But once again, just to go back to Van Halen was a concert that I bought tickets to, and I did the same thing. Now, I ended up wanting to see that, so I paid more. But I was there in good faith at whatever time it was. I'm just defer to the 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and there were no good tickets to be had because they'd all been, in that particular situation, they had mostly gone to promoters. Fine. There's reasons for doing that, and I'm not here we're not here advocating restriction of trade or restriction of concert promotion or whatever, you know, whatever business reason there is for doing that. What we're saying is tell the consumer that what you're advertising, when you most of the websites bring up, here, take the Rose Garden. They'll bring up a little schematic of the Rose Garden, and it will have, you know, different color levels, and we'll tell you, okay, it's $75 for this seating range, and $85 for this seating range, and $115 for these really great seats. That's great, but what they're not telling you is that $115 for those really great seats are really not available.
Interesting. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to say I love my kids more, but my wife did take my three daughters to Hannah, Montana. And let me just say that you didn't miss anything, so it's okay. I just want to thank both of you for bringing this forward and allowing me to sign on. I did sign on to this bill. I do recognize it has some work to be done. I think it says a great deal when you come here. And in fact, I think the media's left because there's really no story here. The bottom line is this is a big issue of consumer protection. We're going to deal with it. It looks like we'll probably hear from the Blazers. They sent us a letter as well. But a lot of these folks that are doing business accordingly, they're probably have a vested interest in how we do this and how we go about it. So thanks for your leadership, and thanks for allowing me to be a part of it. I'm looking forward to seeing where this goes. Thank you.
Representative Widener. Just a quick question for either one of your representatives. How many concerts has this happened in? Because last time I've been to a concert, we had to sleep outside the box office to get tickets. I mean, yeah. I don't go to them anymore. But to me, this seems like we're putting in a burden on the people selling the tickets that we don't need to. I mean, if Hannah Montana's having issues, then the way you solve that is you don't buy the tickets. And then they figure it out really fast when people aren't buying the tickets. So I'm just wondering, in your research, how many times has this happened here at the Rose Garden?
It happens in one degree or another with every event that goes on, every large event that goes on. And how do you define large? Well, we don't know. I mean, one of the things we're amenable to is making sure that an event hits a certain size. I mean, once again, as Rep. Gelser said, we're not interested certainly not the intent, let me put it that way, it's not the intent to adversely or negatively affect any sort of, basically, create a bureaucratic hassle for any small theater companies or the ballet company or anything like that. We're talking about those four or five a year large, widely promoted concert events. And I realize that the way the bill is written, if it's literally interpreted, it's wider than that. And I think I can speak for both of us that we're absolutely amenable to friendly amendment to sort of avoid the unintended consequences and the unintended the unintended entities that would be. Let me say it more simply. We're not trying to get the Trailblazers. I mean, the Trailblazers are a huge asset to the city of Portland, of course, and the state of Oregon. We're not going after. We're not trying to get the fairs and the circuses and those sorts of things. We're trying to get those four or five huge, big national name events that happen, and where the problem that was illustrated by both of us is exasperated. That's what I think we're trying to get after. And to answer your question, does it happen? I mean, yes, it happens. Unfortunately or fortunately, I'm a fan of rock and roll, and all the bands I like to see, or at least did, now the audience is starting to dwindle because they haven't carried the youth with them. But
obviously.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah. But they have these issues. Guns N' Roses is one that came to example. You couldn't buy good Guns N' Roses tickets when they were here two and a half years ago, by going through the normal means. The only way to get good tickets was to go outside, and this bill wouldn't stop that. And Mr. Chair, you need to know this is not, once again, to restrict, okay, the promoters from doing what they need to do. This is asking the promoters to tell us what's going on.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This seems to be, to me, to be the hard way to get at the solution to the problem, which to me seems like banning resale of tickets for more than the stated price. That seems to me to be the actual solution to this problem. I just did a scan on on ORS, looking for scalping, tickets, events, concerts, all sorts of things, and I couldn't find anything. So it seems to me that, and so here's a friendly amendment for you. Let's get this thing
and put in
something that really works, which is, I hope it would really work, which is banning resale of tickets for more than the market values.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If we're having a conversation, Mr. Vice Chair, I think there's some value to looking at that. You've got an enforcement that becomes much more problematic. I mean, it takes the scope of this bill and doubles down, to say the least. And once again, I mean, you know, it's at the chair and the committee's sort of prerogative how they want to go on this. I once again, just going back to the intent. I mean, that's all really we can do in front of you today is to try to advocate with the intent. The intent was not to radically change the ticket buying or selling system in the state of Oregon. The intent was to protect consumers by making that information available, so consumers knew what they weren't actually going to have the ability to buy. And it just prompted the thinking back to Rep. Widener's question about the cost of this. Once again, the intent was that given the way tickets are bought and sold now, this would mostly be web-based sort of deal. The cost would be negligible to zero. You get online to see what tickets you can buy or not buy, and it tells you now if Rep. Gelser buys one seat for a Hannah Montana concert, I come in a minute later, theoretically, and that seat's unavailable. So the system's in place now. We just want that system to be available before the person gets online to think they're going to get front row, and they're not. They're going to get back row.
In your research, have you, not that you probably, neither one of you had a tremendous amount of time to research this, I imagine, but are there other states that basically prohibit the resale of tickets for more than what they bought them for?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that there are some that do that. Another approach that a number of states have taken with what they have called their Hannah Montana bills is to go after those bots and prohibit the use of those bots to go in and buy all of those tickets up. I am very interested in looking more at that. That was something that I became aware of after we had this bill drafted, and clearly that contributes significantly to this problem.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may follow on this, I'm looking at a piece of, it's at least illegal in Arkansas, because I've got a news clip from Arkansas that, you know, so it doesn't talk about the rest of the nation. So, I mean, that's an easy enough question to research. I don't have an answer, though, other than some states do.
That's all right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Member
1213.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is not a terribly unique process for another venue to sell tickets for large events. I have purchased tickets for East Coast events. We went to the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont one year. Very different venues, and I purchased our tickets in advance very differently. At some of those, they are pre-sold to another vendor for which you pay more than the gate, but if you're driving cross country to an event, you're willing to pay a higher price to get the ticket you want, knowing full well that if you were to go and go to the gate, you would get a ticket at a lesser expense. So I think that we should be cautious before we leap into kind of full-blown prohibitions of some things that may make sense. I was interested in the part about tickets being very expensive and then not realizing, or later, closer to the event, they're less expensive. I like what you're saying about information. I think that would be fair information to put out. Pre-ticket for premium seats are available on this date at this time, and then there should be something available, with an understanding or a caveat that if they don't sell out, there might be cheaper seats later if you want to take that risk. But I appreciate the direction you're going with information as opposed to some outright bans on processes that I don't think we've worked through all the legal aspects of, and I think that there probably are good reasons for some of the other ways you access tickets to large events.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the conversation because I think it opens up a larger discussion about how we ended up in a place where the two of you encountered the scenario that you did. And I actually want to go in the opposite direction of Representative Riley and make the point that some of why this happens is because we restrict the ability of the artist to essentially get the value of their performance to them. The reason we have scalping is because there are a set number of tickets, and the ticket price is fixed. And once those tickets are sold, there's still a market for it. There's more people that want to see it than there are tickets, and therefore the price goes up, which is why we get a scalping market secondarily. Now, the artist does not benefit from the fact that people are actually willing to pay more to come see them. And what you see then is, I think, in some ways, these artists and their promoters trying to find a way to get in on that scalping, if you will, so that they can themselves benefit from the fact that people are willing to pay more to see them. And I think the technology that is there, if we're willing to relook at how we regulate this industry, to allow concert venues like the Rose Garden to do something like a reverse auction online. If you've spent any time on eBay or anywhere else, you know that this technology essentially already exists. To start out a Hannah Montana concert by charging $5,000 for every ticket, and every day the price comes down. People willing to pay because they don't want, you know, they're concerned that it will run out, will pay at the price at which they're willing to pay, and the price keeps coming down until all the tickets are sold. And then Hannah Montana, in this case, or Van Halen or anyone else, they have realized the full potential of what people are willing to pay to see them. And it hasn't gone off into secondary scalping communities and others because they were able to do it that way. But I'm pretty sure we prohibit that, and that's why we get the scenarios we get. So I actually, if we're going to stick to this particular subject, I think banning the botting is probably the way to get at it. But I'd like to invite a larger conversation to actually think about why this scenario happens in the first place, and to allow concert venues to do the kind of reverse auctioning that would allow them to sell the tickets at the price everybody who pays understands what they're paying at the time they're paying and why they're paying that amount. And if you want to wait for a lower price and risk that they would run out, you take that risk. But I think that's a much better way to sell what are essentially a finite number of tickets to a larger number of people that would like to go. You find the price point at which people are willing to get in line and pay to see that particular artist. So if that would be something you guys would be open to, I'd be very interested in writing that kind of language that would get at this, and then I don't think we would ever see these kinds of problems again. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't know if you get it by the committee, but
can I respond?
Go ahead.
Do you think, I'm not sure that is prohibited. I mean, I think, I'm not sure there's any prohibition on it. You think that's prohibited?
No, it's not.
I don't know, but part of that, just to go into the earlier part of Representative your comments, yes, I mean, certainly the ticket price is reflected in the market demand, and the more demand there is for whatever product, concert, venue, the higher the value, or at least the higher the sellability of a ticket. But part of that demand is artificially driven, and that's part of the problem as well. Hannah Montana is a good example, and perfect example with Rep. Gelser's point, because the scalpers got on, you know, the bots and everything, but the lion's share,
right,
the vast majority of the tickets for that particular venue. Then they jack the price up, okay, and then all of a sudden there's a short. I mean, we go online, there's no tickets. Oh, my kid's going to kill me, okay. I guess I'm going to pay double. I guess I'm going to pay triple. I guess I'm going to pay quadruple. So part of that ticket price increase is artificial. It's artificially driven by somebody who's corralled, basically has become the OPEC of the ticket for that particular concert, and then starts filling it out and say, well, now, and where that breaks down, because as Rep. Gelser said, when you got to 2 or 3 days before the concert, that price came back down to 100, so it was artificial. I mean, it really wasn't the right price level. It was artificial. So,
Mr. Chair, I've been informed that it's called a Dutch auction, so I just want to change. I called a reverse auction to a Dutch auction.
And Mr. Chair, I would just point out, when that happens, it becomes a debacle for the artist as well. In the case of Hannah Montana, whose name is really Miley Cyrus, it was a terrible public relations scandal for her, because all these local news stations all over the country had crying little girls about how their hearts were broken because they couldn't get in, and what kind of a young teen artist has tickets that are $2,500 for a kid to come to her concert. So the artists are not benefiting from this at all.
No, wait a second. Hannah Montana is who?
Well, Miley Hannah Cyrus. Montana is Miley Cyrus, but it's a secret.
It's complicated. It's
Billy Ray Cyrus.
There's a wig involved. You can't keep
Hannah
up.
Gets mentioned.
The bottom line take home from all of this, Oregon can be the first state where little girls don't cry.
That's a good lot.
I'd be in favor of that.
And if you figure that out,
Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to say it's easy to get in to see your dad. But I pulled up a summary of ticket sales laws of all the states. That's one of the great things about having the computer here. And it turns out there are 9 states which have an absolute ban on scalping, but Alabama's is the one I like best. You pay $100 to the state and you can scalp all you want. There are 9 states that have absolute bans. Oregon has no law on ticket sales whatsoever.
There you go.
So they can do the Dutch auction.
That's right.
Okay.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
What would we do if we had one of these Dutch auctions on food?
Then we'd have a lot of hungry poor people there.
Well, I look at this thing, there has to be a little bit of decency. There has to be, these artists can decide how much they want for that show. And this is the price of the tickets for certain areas. Sell the tickets. If I paid $2,500 and somebody's sitting next to me has paid $300, I mean, I'm going to go after somebody's ears. I mean, I just don't like that idea. I had one of the most expensive golf courses down at Bandon Dunes. I know a person or two in this room has been there, even with me. Was it $285 or $300 around? And it goes down a little in the summer. But as long as they got tee-offs, that's what the price is. And as they get full, they fill up at that price. As the time comes, they don't drop the price to fill it. It doesn't happen.
Well, that's their business. Mr. Chair, I was just going to say that airlines...
Representative Widener's next, please.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We need to be careful on some of these business practices, because I'm just pulling up some of the laws that we have here, but because there's companies like I am, like Representative Cowan here, have purchased tickets when I'm going to the East Coast, and I know they come from scalpers, but there's guys who are going to hold, they buy year-round seats, and they go to maybe 3 of the games, and they sell the rest, and they make a living off of paying for their seats for the season that way. So when they may mark them up $20, or it could be $100. And I think we need to be real careful treading on this territory and telling people how they need to run their businesses. And then even with going back to what Representative Krieger is saying, I mean, if people can sell it for that, then that's what the market would bear. I personally wouldn't pay that much for a ticket myself and would move on, and that's what would regulate how much scalpers would charge for the tickets. So,
Representatives, I think you've kicked off the subject very well. I'd like to release you from this barrage of conversation at this point and let you return to your appointed duties. Thank you very much, and we will continue to have some discourse about this. We have some other people signed up to testify, which I'm sure will provide some information.
Not yet, but there will be
one. Okay, all right. I'm sorry, I thought we had some. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Oh, there's so many. There's so many things.
Next up, I'd like to bring J.E. Isaac, Robin Williams, and John McCauley. Please, introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hovey, and members of the committee. My name is J.E. Isaac. I'm the Senior Vice President of Business Affairs for the Portland Trailblazers and the Portland and Portland Arena Management, which is the owner of the Rose Garden. I'm an attorney that has over 30 years of experience in the sports entertainment business. Over the course of my career, I've promoted concerts, represented platinum recording and touring artists as a personal manager, and have served as an officer and senior executive of the Portland Trailblazers, handling business affairs and overseeing the management of the Rose Garden and Memorial Coliseum. I believe my education and experience qualify me as an expert in the live sports entertainment industry, and I'm here today to express my grave concerns regarding House Bill 2673 and to urge the committee to refrain from forwarding this bill as written to the House. I am very encouraged to hear from the co-sponsors of the bill that they realize that the scope of this bill as it was forwarded to me needs to be drastically reduced, because this is basically trying to kill flies with a shotgun. It's clear that their concern is over a handful of high demand shows that come into the market every year. And the way this bill is written, it would apply to every small play, family show, where most of these events have hundreds or thousands of tickets available for every performance, and there is no problem with an aftermarket at all. I agree with those members of the council, or I'm sorry, of the committee, who have addressed the fact that if we are concerned about the aftermarket, and it's the aftermarket that is creating this price fluctuations that you're concerned about, not the venues and the artists and the promoters who are putting the tickets on sale to begin with. Those tickets are set. They are a set price based on where you're sitting. They are offered for sale. And then as people purchase them, see, it's not just the scalpers that are using robots to go online. People understand that if they're lucky enough to win the lottery and get a seat to the Hannah Montana concert, that is gold. They you know, maybe they don't have children. They're just going online every time a show comes up, and they're seeing whether they can get lucky and get a ticket to it. And if they do, they call their ticket broker and they sell their ticket to the ticket broker, who then turns around and sells it for even more to a family like the representative who testified about Hannah Montana, who was looking at, if she wanted to get her daughter tickets, she was going to have to pay $2,500. Well, if that is the problem that we're trying to address, then work with our industry, who understands how these things work, to address that problem. A statewide scalping ordinance would be a start. There is no statewide scalping ordinance. There is an ordinance in Multnomah County. It's either Portland or
Multnomah County.
But you have to understand the way the Portland area scalpers address that is they just have their offices in Beaverton. The majority of the after-selling market is on computerized internet sites that are in California. So to a certain extent, even having a statewide law against scalping may be difficult to enforce if the activity is taking place online in their headquarters in other states. That will have to be addressed. We were very concerned when we read the initial language that required certain information. We have no problem with supplying information as set forth in this bill, but to require artists and promoters to put that information in advertisements or to have venues post signs, and we realized that we kind of wanted to show you what a sign as required by this current language in the bill, the size that it would be just for a single Blazer game. And we have 10 entrances. We would be required to put a sign like that up at all of those 10 entrances. And by the time we could manufacture and post that sign, the information on it would be inaccurate because the sales continue every hour, every minute. So a way to get that information out would be digitally, if the committee and the legislature decides that is a way to address this problem. But I really don't think that it's the information flow. And I could tell from the testimony of the co-sponsors that there's a real misunderstanding about how our business works. As an industry, we would like to have an opportunity to work with the committee, work with the sponsors, to explain how our industry works. And in doing so, we may identify methodologies that will be effective. I was moved by Representative Brune's comment about we could be the first state where little girls won't cry. I have a son. He's grown up now. But, I understand when you have a child and you want to get that child what they want. And sometimes, there's not many instances in the world where you can't get your child what they want. A Hannah Montana show is one of them because the Rose Garden has 15,000 seats for a typical concert, and there are hundreds of thousands of little girls who want to go see that show. So the little girls are going to cry. 85,000 of them are going to cry because there's only 15,000 seats. However we do this, for the hot tickets, demand is going to exceed supply. And that is what's making an industry for these aftermarket sellers. They are buying tickets from people at inflated prices and then selling them at even larger prices. I would, in closing, just ask that the committee keep in mind that we don't want to create a law that will put Oregon at a disadvantage for getting these types of shows. We are not a must-play market. We are viewed as the concert industry as a secondary market because of the size of our Portland and Oregon, population-wise. We have to compete with Seattle for shows. Many shows won't play every market. So if we are requiring things that are not required in other states, the easiest thing and the cheapest thing for the promoter to do is to just take their show to another state. They can play two shows at Key Arena. They can play two shows at Tacoma Dome in Washington. If Washington doesn't have the information requirements that we would have in Oregon. So we have to be careful that in trying to give little girls an opportunity to see Hannah Montana, that we don't drive Hannah Montana out of the state altogether, where even 15,000 little girls don't get to see her.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I'm having a hard time following that reasoning.
Okay.
So I understand there are only so many tickets, it's limited.
Right.
So I don't understand when you enable the scalpers that are making hundreds of thousands of dollars on this, that's not keeping Hannah Montana here or driving her to Seattle.
No, I'm sorry if you misunderstood.
I don't think I misunderstood.
Oh, okay. It wasn't my intent to state that this had anything to do with the aftermarket.
That we would not have people like Hannah Montana and very popular people coming if we pass this kind of bill.
I'm sorry. Let me clarify what I meant to say, because evidently I was very inartful in expressing it. First of all, we have no problem with the scalping law. If the committee wants to address this problem by saying that it's illegal to sell a ticket for more than the face value, we're very excited about that. What I'm saying is if the committee or the legislature decides to do more than that and goes back to some of the language in this original bill, which requires certain information to be put, for instance, in a national or in the on-sale ad,
right.
The promoters, when they're putting a 30-show Hannah Montana tour on, they use the same ad in every state. So all of a sudden, they'll be looking, oh, wait a minute, in Oregon, we're going to have to put how many seats are available in each price category and blah, 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 blah. That may be the kicker that tells them, well, then let's not worry about Oregon. It's weird. It's too hard to do business there. We'll just do another show in Seattle. That's the part that I was talking about.
Thank you.
Why we might lose Hannah Montana.
Thank you for clarifying.
Not scalping, and I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think you gave a pretty good testimony, and I appreciate your comments, you know, but sometimes, you know, maybe this bill is a shotgun, you know, after a fly, but when you get bit by a horsefly, sometimes you want to use a shotgun to fix it.
That's right.
So anyway, just wanted to throw that out. If you'd identify yourself for the record and provide us your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. My name is Robin Williams. I'm the Executive Director of the Portland Center for the Performing Arts in Portland, but I'm also here wearing another hat. I am the president of the International Association of Assembly Managers, which is an association of venue managers who run performing arts centers, stadiums, arenas, convention centers, and amphitheaters all over the world. We have over 4,000 members. We have 53 member venues here in Oregon, and I'm here on their behalf to oppose the current bill as it's currently written for many of the same reasons that Jay has mentioned. The signage you saw, if I can put that in perspective, yesterday at the Performing Arts Center, we had 229 performances on sale. That would, under the current bill, we would have 229 signs with a variety of information as stated in the bill. It would be impossible for us to keep the information accurate in a way that would even be relevant to the public. I heard it stated that this is an issue that really affects only our 4 or 5 major concerts, and I would beg to differ with that. We regularly see small shows, and we've certainly seen it in my own venues in Portland, where a show that's playing in an 800-seat venue is so popular that it sells out in a few minutes. A few years ago, we were only able to offer 1 week of Wicked, the Broadway show. The demand was very high. It sold out in very, very short order, and a lot of those tickets went out of the market. So to the industry's point, what we're seeing in the bill currently does not address that issue. We venues strongly support public access to our tickets. And as the venues are often important parts of their community, it's important that the members of our community get access to those tickets. This bill does not currently address that. The bill currently lays out a process that would be a huge burden on venues. It would take a lot of additional staffing to provide the signage and to keep up with the information that's required. Just the systems that would need to be in place would be very onerous, and particularly on some of our smaller venues that just don't have the resources to gather this information quickly and keep it regularly updated. To the point about the national promoters, Jay is absolutely correct in that Portland is not an A market. partly from our population, also by just because of our proximity from where the shows are coming. We're often pretty far away from the origination of the shows. So we have to work very hard to make sure that shows come and play in our market. And there is sort of a trickle-down effect. Some of the shows can afford to play smaller venues, smaller markets, because they can come in and hit a Portland and then run down to the Brit Festival in Jacksonville or down to the Criterion in Ashland. And so if we start to have processes that make it very difficult for the venues to meet these costs, if the venues have to figure out, okay, we have to comply, so what do we do with these extra charges? Oh, we're going to have to charge the people bringing the shows into the halls. That starts to put us at a disadvantage. We do believe that the reselling piece does put the venues at sort of a disadvantage, because the venues in the state would work hard to comply with whatever law they would need to. But there are a large number of the resellers that are not in this market that would not have to comply at all, and that does put the venues at a disadvantage. We don't feel that the public is protected. We very much, as I said, support the public access to the tickets. We're very pleased to hear that there is an openness to amendments, and we would very much like to be part of the discussion so that we can find some solutions, because the big issue, which is really the scalping issue, isn't fair to any of us. It's not fair to the public, the venues, the promoters, or the artists. And we are very much interested as an industry to work on this issue, and we would very much like to work with you on any legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. If we go ahead and get Mr. McCauley's testimony on the record, please. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCauley, here representing the Oregon Fairs Association. Our association includes all of the 36 county fairs in the state, plus the Oregon State Fair, and in addition, about 150-plus providers of goods and services to those fairs, including promoters, artists, et cetera. I have to tell you, I wish we had the problem of excess demands for people wanting to go to the county fairs. That would be a great problem to have. But we're one of those small entities that are dealing with some of the real problems that exist in this bill. And I think the sponsors of the bill accurately describe the fact that this may be overly broad. And if you just look at the definition of entertainment event, you would see that it would include almost all of the activities that would occur during the time of a county fair. Not only the admission to the fair itself as an entertainment site, but buying the carnival tickets, buying concert tickets, buying rodeo tickets, or any other activity where another ticket is required during the time of the fair. So over that 4 or 5 day period of the fair, multiplied by every event that may be occurring at that site, which requires a ticket, really creates some significant burdens. And I am pleased, as the other witnesses are, that the sponsors of the bill are willing to discuss amendments, because I think the bill is overly broad. I could go on with some other issues that we would have, but I know you have other witnesses, and I think that by working with the sponsors of the bill, hopefully we can come up with something that is workable for you and them.
Thank you, all three of you, for that offer. I think it's absolutely critical that we have your input to any kind of legislation that we would bring forward on something like this, because certainly I don't think it's the intent of any of the sponsors of the bill or anyone on this committee to negatively impact our venues here in Oregon. We strictly do not want to do that, but at the same time, I think there's a lot of interest in seeing that the public does have access at a reasonable price, and not have people profiteering off of their want to go see a good show. And having said that, I'll Representative Krieger.
Just, you know, talk about grandkids or your children wanting to go see these Hannah Montana. My granddaughter doesn't think Hannah Montana. She wants to go see Sarah Brightman, who I think's either been there or going to be there in the new future. So I've got to really, really quick find out the process to get before they go up.
Good luck. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. First of all, our Washington County Fair, as you know, has done much better since we made it free. But that's beside the point. I just was curious if any of you would have any objections to the laws like North Carolina, South Carolina, or Rhode Island, which prohibits reselling except for a reasonable charge of up to $1, $2, $3 above the price of the ticket.
The Trailblazers are currently using a system that allows our season ticket holders to resell their tickets if they can't use them.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would like to do is just make sure that there would at least be an opportunity to charge a service charge to facilitate to facilitate that transaction, because
right.
it does cost something to set that up.
These things allow up to $3. Is that sufficient?
$3 doesn't buy as much as it used to.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm new to the legislation, and I won't apologize for that. I just say, I mean, historical perspective is everything, and sometimes, in this case, I think it would help. Ms. Williams, you're the president of the International Association of Assembly Managers, and I appreciate you representing a lot of folks. So I'm kind of curious. You made a comment that you strongly support public access to the tickets. You also said that you didn't feel the public was protected, and you want to be part of the solution. Can you tell me what you've done in your position with this body up to this point to participate in maybe stopping the scalping that's occurred? Because we kind of recognize, and if nothing else, this has brought all of us together to identify this process and the problem. But can you kind of let me know, have you worked with this body in the past? Have you been attempting some legislation, or where are we on that?
What's going on in what we refer to as the secondary ticket market, which is all the ticket reselling companies, is... I can tell you it is a topic of conversation at every association meeting that we have. For example, I just returned from a meeting of performing arts facility managers in Atlanta a few weeks ago, and it, again, was a topic of conversation. And thus far in the industry, we have not been able to come up with solid ideas that will just stop this, because our venues are subject to their state laws, and policies vary from state to state. Some of the discussion that we've had is it possible to work, encourage our states to work with other states to attempt a more national ban on scalping, but our feelings are as then it will just move outside the boundaries of the United States, because with it all being internet driven, it has the ability to go anywhere. We talk a lot amongst ourselves on what can we do on the individual venues to try and stop scalping. And it varies from venue to venue, but, for example, some venues may hold back some tickets from the big initial sale, knowing that the secondary ticket market will launch early to grab tickets very early, and so we'll hold back tickets and then release those later. There's some ways that our box office, for example, at PCPA, can tell by how something is sold by running credit cards and looking at where we try and limit the number of tickets that can be sold. And if we see, this is a scalper, we actually will go back and and cancel the order. So there's little things like that. We may, but that's chipping away at such small numbers that the big problem, that the swooping in and picking up thousands of tickets at any one time, has we have not found a way to continue to make that work. So we don't have any answers. I wish we did, because I would have loved to have shown up today and said, here's the answer to your problem. But
so it just prompts a question before I go on to Representative Barton. In listening to you, I'm getting the feeling that you feel that we wouldn't be able to regulate the aftermarket sale of tickets from people who operate outside of the state of Oregon, even if they are buying the tickets from within the state of Oregon and selling them to people in Oregon. So, I mean, you're a lawyer. Can you address that?
Yes. I think it just comes down to a question of nexus and siting of the business and the activity. You know, where does the activity take place? Does it take place in California, where that internet server is that makes that transaction, or does it take place, you know, where the person is selling or where the person is buying? You know, I don't know that there is legal precedent that has looked at that. I don't know if there is case law, but I mean, I would say this, that it would be a great first step to make scalping illegal in the state of Oregon, and then you could pursue the legalities of whether you would have the legal standing, the nexus they call it, to go after an out of state operator for sales that were for venues in the state of Oregon. But I can't tell you the answer to that.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. I guess I was alluding to that. But, we try to do that sometimes. Through Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to actually respond to a comment made by Representative Matthews, because I wanted to respectfully disagree. Cause in terms of if this committee has reached a unanimous consensus of the problem at hand, I'm not quite there yet. These unfortunate situations that I think inspired this bill are caused when essentially demand vastly exceeds supply. And that could happen at a large venue, a small venue. That could happen even with the Blazers, although if for example, when they go to the finals. That is the fundamental issue here. And I'm deeply skeptical that this legislature can address that problem in an administrable way. Nor actually am I convinced that, for example, banning the resale market is a solution to the problem. Indeed, I think it might exacerbate it, in that I don't think we will actually, the nine states that have banned it, I happen to know for a fact that resale still happens. What happens, if anything, it decreases transparency and increases prices, because the resellers would incorporate a risk premium. And although I really appreciate your willingness to work with the proponents of the bill, I myself am not convinced that we really can address this problem of the supply-demand disequilibrium. When demand exceeds supply, prices will increase, and that is normal market behavior. That is an unfortunate reality, and I don't think we can change it or should change it.
Thank you for the free market analysis. Representative Gilliam.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. You're very generous.
Try to be.
I know that. Could the representative from the Blazers just re-identify himself?
Jay Isaac.
Jay, do you know the famous actress Betty Moyer?
I do indeed.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time with her.
Good. Mr. Chair, I just hope you'll indulge me for 60 seconds, because there's something I want to say on record about the Portland Trailblazers. And since we've talked about this bill for so long, I think I deserve a minute. And that's simply this. There's a young lady in my district who is a Rotary exchange student from France. And I made a contact with the Portland Trailblazers because this young lady experienced that horrific tragedy of several of her classmates being murdered
right in front of her very eyes. She has not had a very good experience in the United States of America. And Todd, the guy that runs around at the Blazers and says, you know, Representative Tomei, you've won a free shot at the car.
Well, what's Todd's, you know who I'm
talking about? Bosma. Todd Bosma is our sort of master of ceremonies.
Well, Todd went and found, I contacted the, I happen to know the host parents, and Todd brought them down from their nosebleed seats and put them right behind the Blazers bench for this game with the San Antonio Spurs. And you all may know that Tony Parker, probably the MVP of the league, is kind of hot. he's a great basketball player. He's married to a movie star, and he's a great player, and he's from France. And after the game, Todd took this young lady who's living in our district for this exchange backstage, and she got to meet Tony Parker, have her picture taken with him, speak in French, and she stayed up late enough when she got home to Silverton to call her brother in France that morning to tell him what happened. And it's the first time she's probably smiled since she's been here, and I appreciate it very much.
But what about Batum?
Yes, that's right. He's pretty hot too, isn't he?
And she spoke, to him.
Thanks, Representative.
Yeah,
that's
cool.
Good story.
I'm glad thanks. You got to see him, too.
Thanks for doing that.
Oh, Representative Widener.
Just a real quick one, because I think my colleague and I are here having taken the opposite sides of our party lines, but I'm looking at the ticket prices here that were going on, and some of them are $149 to $6,975, and it looks to me like this is a good way from the poor to take from the rich so they can have more. So it's their way of getting money back from the rich, because I couldn't afford $6,975, and looks like a good place to make money. So scalping these tickets. But to get to the core point after seeing this is there any way to really stop bots? So, because it's going to move to another country. It's going to keep moving around. And when it's done on the Internet, I mean, when you see that, I would be outraged. I just wouldn't go to the show. And the only way to stop it is stop buying them off the Internet.
Our experience is once you stop one thing, a new one is something else is created that takes over. And that's sort of been our experience thus far. That before bot, we thought we found ways to block. And then the bot came and just overrode all the other protections that we put in. So
Technology, you know, it's like the law, and it can't keep up with technology right now. That's really the situation in so many areas.
Looks like we've exhausted our questions for you, gentlemen and ma'am. I hope that you will think about solutions and work with the sponsors of the bill to see if there is some way that we can come up with a partial solution, perhaps, that makes the situation better than it is today in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to that.
Next up, I'd like to have Chris Oxley and Tom Gallagher. Good afternoon and welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chairperson Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Chris Oxley. I am the general manager of the Rose Quarter, which includes the Rose Garden and the Coliseum.
If you'd like to give us your testimony,
that would
be great.
You bet. I've prepared testimony, which you guys all have, so I'll kind of limit I'll limit my testimony to some degree and hopefully take some questions. We're kind of at the center of this to some degree, or at least I am. My job duties entail management of the Rose Garden and the Coliseum, which involves the booking of entertainment and ticket operations. And I apologize, I should have said I'm here to comment on and oppose House Bill 2673. Our events bring approximately 2 million people to our campus on an annual basis, drawing from all over the country and the world. We're obviously a major employer in the city of Portland and provide a significant impact to the city, county, and state. I feel this bill is detrimental to our success, and the requirements of this bill are onerous to our business. I'm I don't want to be repetitive here today, so if that's quite all right, my colleagues and friends in the business have talked about this quite a bit today. I guess what I would say, and kind of what to get away from my testimony and just comment on kind of what I'm hearing today, it seems as though to some degree we're blurring the lines between legitimate and illegitimate sales and legitimate and illegitimate secondary market. I would echo what was said here today, that the secondary market is a tough one to tackle, and that it's likely not going to go away or go away very easily. There are auctions available, and we engage in those auctions. I think that was a question that was brought up earlier as part of our legitimate ticket sales. We are not engaged in the secondary market, and as a facility, as a campus, we do not allow the resale of tickets on our campus. So, and I wish, honestly, every show sold out like Hannah Montana, because that's just not, unfortunately, that's not our reality. We're engaged in a business that is a very low margin, a very high risk, and with a very small percentage of sellouts. So I won't belabor the point today, and at this point, if there's any questions or if you want to turn it over to Testimia.
Thank you. Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Gallagher, representing the newspapers. I'm here to switch gears a little bit and talk about the advertising piece of it, not the venue piece. I appreciate that you exempted radio from the requirements, but I don't represent the radios, so maybe I can get them. I represent newspapers, and the list of things we have to put in the newspapers is, again, a requirement of space and requirement of cost for the advertising would have an impact. Since this bill has been printed and come out, we have been receiving calls from the different events and different organizations that use the newspaper for advertising, saying, get down there, this would mean we couldn't advertise in the newspaper. The last thing I'd say about that is the lag between submission of print media and the requirements of the bill to have to keep up with that would be impossible. As soon as we printed the ad for the venue, we'd be in violation, because tickets would have been sold in different places at different times, and all that material that we would be required to put in the print would be out of date. So you can't exempt one advertising piece from this and not the others. And we would be happy to work on this bill, but I don't know how to solve it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tomei, question?
Yeah, quick question. Tell me about auctions.
We have the ability, prior to the on sale of an event, the technological ability to have an auction that is open to anyone that would like to participate in the purchase of tickets. The minimum bid is generally the face value of the price, the face value of the ticket itself. I've seen plenty of auctions that have actually sold tickets at the face value. There's a certain number of tickets that will be peeled away from the public on sale to provide that experience for people that do want to pay. That is really a response to what the artists have asked for, to say, we want people to have an opportunity to pay us what they think we're worth. And that money stays with the artist. It goes back to them, and it's included in the guarantee, or I'm sorry, in the gross tickets for the sales.
Follow-up, please?
Follow-up.
Thank you. So what proportion, say, of somebody like Hannah Montana, a really popular performer, so what proportion of tickets would go to auction?
Generally a very, very small percent, 1% or less.
And to whom would they go? Who would bid at auction?
Anybody that cares to. It's open to the public. Absolutely. You'd be more than welcome. Absolutely.
Before the tickets go on sale, is that
yes.
true?
Yes, yes.
So how would somebody know about that?
It's generally publicized in our website. The fans would, fan clubs usually make that information available. The artists make that information available.
Really?
We send out emails stating to anybody that signs up for our email database that, hey, there's going to be an auction available for this show.
And it would be an online auction?
Yes, yes.
And anybody can do that?
Anybody
how
can
many,
do that.
How for as many tickets as they want?
No, there's a fixed amount. in general, this is driven by the artist or the management or the agent that for the artist that they want to provide this, and occasionally it will have additional amenities associated with it. May it be parking, special parking, or a dinner, or a meet and greet, or a backstage pass, or a picture, something to that effect. It's generally got to be manageable and provide a more VIP experience, I guess, to the general public.
So the artist would do this, not to you.
That's not up to me, because it's the face value of the ticket goes to the artist. It's not
right.
It's not my money.
Okay.
So they have that opportunity to
come out. And they do this. They do the auction, not you.
No, we facilitate the auction through our ticketing company. So we facilitate all sales of tickets, all legitimate sales of tickets through our ticketing company. So they will tell us.
Last question. And the money goes to the artist.
Money goes to the artist.
Thank you.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of want to just kind of reflect back on kind of the intent when we first started the conversation. And that was this was surrounding kind of just the transparency of how many tickets would be available. Mm-hmm. Understanding that every venue, regardless of what the act might be, you would have already discounted or given blocks of tickets to some corporate sponsors, some ticket holders, radio stations. I mean, there would be promotions available where those tickets would be relieved. I think what the co-sponsors and talking to them, this is more about, even though we've discussed on how we sell these tickets and what we do, this really, if you boil it down, was more about the initial, I'm interested in going to the concert, how many tickets are truly available to the public for sale? Is that impossible to deliver? And now keep in mind, too, that, the letter I received, and I appreciate your experience in the industry, Mr. Isaac, your experience as well, everybody's experience here. But this isn't about, having a running ticket number, somebody standing by that 12-foot sign to change the number with every ticket sale. This is about, what are my chances of buying a ticket when they first come available? Is that impossible to ask that you would let somebody know that out of the 12,000 seats in the Rose Garden, or 18,000 or whatever you have, that there's only 11,000 seats available for public purchase?
It is challenging to some degree, and so the Rose Garden is a 20,000 seat facility, okay? Not every concert goes up with 20,000 seats. We had a very successful concert the other night with Brad Paisley. Phenomenal show. We opened that for sale up at with the upper deck close, 300 level close, curtaining down. They wanted an intimate experience for 7,000 or 8,000 people, but an intimate experience nonetheless. That show did great numbers. It was phenomenal. It sold out in the lower bowl. They base their decision on how many tickets they're going to sell at what price because they have to pay an artist X amount. Right? What we did in that particular show was create additional supply. We opened curtains in the 300 level. We repriced the event and created an opportunity for people to buy tickets that they wouldn't have otherwise. Let's say if we would have put the information out prior to that event, that there were 7,000 seats available and 7,000 seats sold, how could we have ever done that after that fact, right? Except through maybe additional advertising and changing the message. And then we very easily could have been accused of you're just trying to create your own demand. That wasn't the point. Is that reasonable?
No, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
No, it does, but I just kind of, based on our conversations today, I just kind of want to also caution us, because the speculation of the average person could be venues don't care what happens to tickets as long as they put enough seats and fill the seats. Beyond that, they don't care. And so I get what you're saying, and you met the demand of the people, but when you hear radio stations say you've got to join our online group to have a chance to buy select tickets for Taylor Swift, on this morning, only exclusive to our listeners, that's a pool of tickets that have already been earmarked for that. So those wouldn't be available to the public unless you went online and registered with that particular radio. In this case, it's the Wolf Online.
Sure.
But I just getting back to what we originally talked about, this was about, wasn't about a chart like that. It wasn't about a running ticket in a ticket counter. This is about what's available to the consumer when they first log on to attend an event.
To expand on your question just to a certain degree, the traditional on sale is gone. there were no longer the day of waiting, sleeping in your sleeping bag out in front of the box office, right? To create this opportunity to be the first in line, it doesn't exist anymore. Where that got away from us, I don't know. I can't tell you, but it has. So there's fan clubs, there's pre-sales, there's sponsors, there's artist holds for friends and family, for that matter, that come off the table to some degree. To me, that's almost a little sad. I really actually appreciated it when there was a general excitement on a Saturday morning at 10 o'clock to go stand in front of a ticketing company, right? To be the first guy. I don't know that we'll ever see those days again, to be perfectly honest. I'd love to create that. We have a very exciting event in WWE wrestling. It's got a fan base like none other. We have a group of individuals that actually still pop a tent out in front of the Rose Garden a week before that event goes on sale, and I am the happiest man on earth to be able to see the excitement and the level of excitement for that. But it's just not the reality in terms of where we're at this point. And quite honestly, they have to create, not, I go back to my point, I wish every show sold like Hannah Montana. They don't. They have to create their own excitement through fan clubs, through pre-sales, through artist opportunities to be able to get to the point where they make their dollar. Because at the end of the day, it's the promoter who's on the hook for $1 million for an artist, $500,000 for an artist. It's fair.
I understand. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I think we've exhausted our questions on this particular issue for right now. I really appreciate you showing up and testifying.
Thank you, Chair.
On this bill.
Sounds so simple.
Yeah, it did. I was going to ask if we just did away with internet cells. Maybe that would do it. But
can I make one comment?
Certainly.
One thing I must tell you, and what is frustrating for me, and to hear, and I didn't catch the gentleman's name, but one of the co-sponsors of the bill, talking about how he engages in the illegal secondary market through Craigslist is incredibly frustrating. We're trying to fight that. It's fraught with liability and fraud. We're catching people all the time that we're saying, don't do it. You're going to get caught. You're going to get clipped. You're going to lose your money. And he's bringing together a bill to say, I want to stop what could be conceived as fraud, yet he's engaging in it. And that's, for us, a very challenging place for us to be.
Well, I appreciate your comments, and I hope that you can keep your brain attached to this issue and maybe help others come up with some, at least partial, solutions to this problem.
Thank you.
With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 26 or 73. And I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2614. Victoria, give us a brief description of the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2614 requires landlords of dwellings located in 100-year floodplains to notify tenants, allows tenants who have not received notification and suffered subsequent uninsured flood loss to recover the lesser of actual loss or 2 months' rent from landlords.
Thank you. And first up, on behalf of Representative Buckley, we have Andrew Ainsworth signed up.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andrew Ainsworth, and I'm here on behalf of Representative Buckley, who unfortunately couldn't make it. I bring you a relatively simple bill today, House Bill 2614. I see Representative Laffin. Last session, during my experiences here before this wonderful committee, my simple bills blew up in my face. So hopefully that won't happen this time around. But it does please me that most of the people in the hearing room left. Hopefully there is nobody against this bill, but we shall find out. Basically, current statute requires that when a seller is selling their house, they must notify potential buyer, whether or not the house is located 100-year floodplain as defined by FEMA. This would basically bring the same, idea to rentals. And, let's face it, those who are renting are probably those most likely to be affected by a flood, those least likely to have, flood insurance, that sort of thing. So all it does is require that the landowner or the landlord notify a potential tenant in writing if the building or if the property is located 100-year floodplain, and failure to do so and would only have a negative effect on the landlord should there actually be a flood and should there be an uninsured loss. And so there are a couple ifs there, and then the landlord would be required to pay either 2 months' rent or the amount of the damage caused, whichever is less. According to listed counsel, that's kind of standard for a landlord, kind of sort of matters. So that's about all I have to mention here. I did note that everybody on the committee voted in favor of the smoking notification law that was passed through here, through the full House a little while ago. So I hope that you'd extend that same to this bill. Are there any questions? Okay.
Representative Krieger.
If it's reasonable to require that, is it to notify the tenant where he is? Is it unreasonable to require the tenant, if he's going to live there, to have flood insurance?
Well, that would be up to the legislature to decide, I suppose.
Okay.
Yeah, I might offer something. I suppose this bill's meant to give the opportunity of the tenant to know that it's in a floodplain and they can insure their personal property. Or choose not to and take that risk. So I would imagine the landlord, if they're in a 100-year floodplain, already has flood insurance on their property, but it may not cover the tenant.
Tenant's property, that's right.
The chair is wise.
Other questions, Representative Tomei?
I don't really have a question, only I live in the floodplain, and I'm not required to have flood insurance, and I don't. Unless I have a loan on the house, which I don't have.
Mm-hmm. Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to ask the same question. I'm trying to wonder how useful this is. We're talking about apartment renters and perhaps people in mobile parks.
No, it specifically exempts mobile home parks.
So we're talking about only apartment dwellers.
No, not only apartment dwellers, people who live in rentals, which could include houses.
Okay.
Other questions?
I don't know if it's a question or a comment, but I see.
Well, we're not going to work the bill today. You can certainly think about it. I think the bill's relatively straightforward. That gives tenants an opportunity to decide whether they want to insure their personal belongings when they rent a place that happens to be in a 100-year floodplain.
Well, it also, Mr. Chair, creates a liability. I mean, we are adding a liability in the statute, too.
To the landlord of informing the tenant, yes.
Yeah, if he doesn't inform.
Yeah,
him,
yeah. Yeah, there would be a liability there. That's true. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony today.
I thank you for being gracious.
With that, committee, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2614. And we're not going to hear House Bill 2613 today. We will carry it over until Friday. So we will... At this point on Friday, we also have scheduled 2566 and 2779. So with that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.